This is an ABC podcast.
Hi there, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. This is David Rutledge, and I'm very glad you could join me this week for a conversation about angst and hope, albeit a very particular kind of angst and a very particular kind of hope. My guest this week is Cassie Chodosho. She teaches philosophy at the University of the Philippines, and she's a founding member of Women Doing Philosophy, or WDP, which is a group of women Filipino philosophers dedicated to pushing back against sexism and discrimination within the profession. Cassie Chodosho has written about the existence of a patriarchal culture within academic philosophy in the Philippines, which can make things very difficult for women working in the discipline. And for signs of hope, she draws on a philosophical resource which is perhaps a little surprising. Cassie is a scholar of the 18th century German philosopher Immanuel Kant, who had a lot to say about hope. But like many blokes of his day, Kant also held views that we would today describe as sexist and racist. So how does a Filipino woman philosopher deal with that? That's all coming up a little later in the conversation. There is, you say, a conservative culture and a masculinist culture that exists in Filipino philosophy. Can you tell me about that? How does that culture manifest itself?
Personally, my experience with seeing the misogyny is when I attended some conferences in the Philippines. So, of course, when we are in the classroom as philosophy instructors, we always aspire for the ideal classroom, the ideal relationship, the ideal method of philosophizing with others, with one another. So since most of the time, the majority of the conference population or members of organizations here in the Philippines are still men. So it was one of those instances which I personally was a pivoting moment for how I viewed philosophy in the Philippines. That's why from those experiences, I was actually looking for a space, looking for members of philosophers in the Philippines that could understand or that could relate to what I am experiencing and what other underrepresented groups of philosophers in the Philippines are experiencing as well. I think it is important really to form a community of not just having like-mindedness, but also a community where we can articulate about our experiences. Because sometimes you are unaware that those experiences are detrimental, not just to our own philosophy career or philosophy profession, but also to ourselves. And that by having, at the very least, the existence of a space provides us with the comfort, the care, and the confidence that, okay, I can do this. We can do this. It's not because I'm just this one. That's why I can't do it. It might be because there are certain structural things that inhibit us from pursuing other things that I can pursue more. So I think that's one of the important things that building a community has provided us with. The other thing is because of the building of WDP or Women Doing Philosophy, since we are entering to our fourth year now, in a way, there are certain reverberations. I could not, of course, when you're trying to understand a particular situation, you tend to be aware of certain attachments, certain frequencies that you get from your network, from your other network, because you know them from your school days, you know them from your conferences, your meetings, etc. In a way, I can also feel that there's a little bit of pushback or questions about why do they need to have another organization that's only for women. So my reaction to that is, okay, they notice us, they're noticing us. And the reception is not, wow, there is another organization of philosophers in the Philippines. But there are reactions of, why is it only for women and why are they banded together as a group? So I felt that we have been ruffling feathers near the Philippines as well.
But what are the particular harms suffered by women philosophers working in this culture? How does it affect you?
Yeah, usually we get it for microaggressions. The first one is that when you do meetings, usually it's always the women who would have to do the minutes. So those are particular things, or would have to arrange the food for the minutes, those things. So in a way, it's under the general category of the women's always has the burden of care. So women philosophers are not just seen as philosophers, but we most of the time we're also seen as the carers, the primary carers, not just of our students in the classroom, but also of our colleagues in the whole university. So the stereotype is that we are supposedly the voices of reason. But for a woman philosopher, it's not just about being a voice of reason, but also carrying the burden of caring and service to whatever space we find ourselves into. The other thing is that the distribution of work really tends to get a little bit heavier on women. Because, for example, in some universities, for us to be, what is that word, promoted, one has to have research, one has to have extension work, one has to have committee works or admin works, aside from your teaching. So, for example, if a woman philosopher has a family or is a primary carer for their own households, then it gets difficult to get the points for the promotion. That's why, in a way, it's difficult to climb the academic ladder if that is still that situation that we are faced with. And I think the other thing is that women rarely get positions in philosophical organizations. Maybe 10 years or 15 years ago, it's normal to have all officers or board of trustees of organizations, to have all men officers. But now, it's a good thing that there are now women, a couple number of women philosophers as officers. But from what I understand is that it's important as well to see a number of women or an all-women leadership in an organization and people not batting an eyelash about it. And not just women, of course, underrepresented groups here in the Philippines as well, queer folk that are doing philosophy. We have not been having that conversation here in the Philippines. And I hope soon there will be more conversations about it.
Yeah. It sounds like what you're describing is something that is really structural. I mean, it's not just a problem of having a few professors or university administrators that have these outdated attitudes. It sounds like it goes deeper than that, right?
Yeah, that's right. Although, well, for the Philippines, I've been reading some reports. The gender differentiation of work is, we have a good scoring in the gender index. But of course, we have to make sure that we do more every day in whatever spaces that we find ourselves in. Because from my end, I'm actually thinking of the students as well. Of course, we will not be philosophers forever. There will be next batches of philosophers. And I think it is important for us instructors or professors to show to our philosophy students that, okay, this is not the normal thing that is happening. You can change and you can introduce change in whatever you think is justified for your particular generation, and continue philosophizing and continue asking and criticizing whatever events, organizations, even our decisions, so that we make sure that philosophy is alive and well. The other thing is that, yes, it's structural, and I hope that this would be addressed. If not, well, there's really no soon in the academe because it has to go through the bureaucracy and all the other things. But again, I always go back to the classroom. I think the classroom provides us with a space, even if there's just one person, two people. I think that provides us with the working handle of how we might want to include or to introduce change into philosophy itself.
Yeah, and there's a challenge there, isn't there, in that academic philosophy is traditionally very conscious of intellectual boundaries, whereas you're describing something which is a lot more interdisciplinary, and that tendency or willingness to look beyond the traditional boundaries of philosophy, that seems to me to be very characteristic of feminist philosophy, right?
Yeah, because maybe underrepresented groups in philosophy has a different experience on how we interact with the canon, or how we can use the canon and illuminate how our experiences are might be because of the canon, or how the canon can help us further articulate and provide creative solutions. I feel that there's also a pushback with regard to technology as well. I'm not sure if I'm just a lenient person, but I've always seen innovation, may that be in technology, may that be in management or administration, and to test it with however we do pedagogy, however we do our philosophical research. Because if we do not try testing our philosophical ideas, philosophical problems with current methods, may that be in technology, again, in AI or language models, then there is the danger that we are only running in self-limited spaces and circles wherein we know what we are talking about. I'm not saying that it's not important to talk about the canon or to these spaces, but what I'm saying is that there is a lot of possibilities expanding, disrupting the canon, and then introducing different points of view so that we can further enrich philosophy and philosophizing. I think that's not a bad thing. Some people would fear it. I'm not sure why. But I think, again, one of the pillars of philosophizing, asking questions and criticism, has to be supported.
I have a question for you as a woman working within the academy. I think about what we sometimes hear in feminist responses to the push for women's ordination in the Catholic Church, right? Because one very interesting response is the one that asks, why on earth do women want to be part of an organization that has historically done so much harm to women and which is patriarchal to the core? And so instead of fighting for roles within this rotten institution, why don't women just leave the church? And so I want to ask you a version of that question, but with regard to academic philosophy, which is, why does feminism as a social movement need academic philosophy?
From my end, it's how we do feminist philosophy is philosophy. And of course, we clarify our concepts, our methodologies with the same standards of philosophical rigor. Because from my point of view, from my schema of things, feminist philosophy or feminism is part of philosophy, or a category of philosophy and philosophizing. There is an article here in the Philippines, which was also countered by another woman philosopher, if philosophy needs a feminism, or if feminism is a philosophy. That was years ago, and that was also answered by one of my colleagues, a woman philosopher as well. For me, it's problematic that we do not put structure into things that we are studying, because I think that's how I think. I like structures, I like a good beginning, a good methodology, and a good end. And I think it helps to have structures or schemas and frameworks in feminist philosophy, in aesthetics, in contemporary philosophy. Why? Because it helps us understand where there might be gaps, where there might be intersections for further clarification, for further deliberation. And so, and it also provides us with a highlight, or with a vision, or with a way on which other things we can work on, what challenges may arise, and how other categories in philosophy can help us understand why this is a problem in feminist philosophy, or why in a way there are a small number of women philosophers doing philosophy of science, philosophy of mind, philosophy of mathematics. So I think they work hand in hand rather than contra one another.
On Radio National and ABC Listen, this is The Philosopher's Zone, and my name is David Rutledge. I'm speaking this week with Cassie Chidosho from the University of the Philippines. She's a founding member of the Women Doing Philosophy group in the Philippines, which is dedicated to pushing back against sexism and discrimination within the world of academic philosophy. So up until now, we've been, I guess, diagnosing a problem that you've rather nicely described as philosophical angst. Let's turn to, well, maybe not a solution to the problem, but a productive way of working through the problem,
yes,
which you have found in the work of Immanuel Kant, especially in this idea of Kantian hope. So first of all, just what do you understand by that term? What is Kantian hope?
Yeah, I see it as two things, not just an emotion. It's more of an attitude and a standpoint, a critical standpoint upon which we can judge and we can approach certain things, may that be in ethics, may that be in religion, may that be in anthropology, and may that be in everyday life. So what it means is that we do not only see ourselves merely as thrown into the world, a la Heidegger, or we do not only see ourselves as workers, we do not only see ourselves as this part of a particular society, but we see ourselves rooted in this idea that we can hope for the things that might not necessarily be known right now, but provides us with the space to philosophize, reflect about it, and judge about it, and judge certain actions, decisions, and thoughts from that standpoint. So in a way, we go back to the one of the first things that Kant said in the Critique of Pure Reason, that we have things, or we want things, we desire things that are most especially beyond our thinking, our rational faculties. But we can speculate about it, and because of the speculation, it enlarges not only the philosophical landscape, I think, but the human landscape of possibilities. And I think that's where Kant can hope, as a standpoint, helps us understand where we are in this particular post-pandemic world, how we are with our lives, how we are with our fellow human beings, and imagine what the world would be without us, beyond us. And I think those are fruitful things to philosophize about. That's why I gravitate towards. And that's how I understand Kant and hope as well.
Right. So you're picking up on this idea then of Kant as hope as something more than an emotion. Like Kant thinks of it as sort of a rational disposition, a rational assessment of possibilities. So I get that, and that is all sort of bent towards the right of a person to expect happiness, I guess. I mean, all human hope for Kant is directed towards happiness. But morality is in there as well. I mean, you mentioned morality, and that one interests me because hope for Kant involves a commitment to moral principles.
Yes.
How does that work exactly? How does morality inform his understanding of hope?
I think there's always, when I read his works, especially in the ethics part, I feel that he always puts his trust on human beings. That from his point of view, there's always the goodwill, that the human person would always rationally choose to do the good. So I always get that feeling when I read his works in the Critical Project and some of his works in Ethics. In a way, from how I view it, it makes sense. Because when we do things, especially when we add another person to the equation, in a way, we trust that the other person understands what we are saying, where we are coming from, because in a way, we are sharing the same human experience. The second one is that, at the very least, we also understand that the good is a value to the other person, that at least there's a rule or a criteria of a certain rightness or wrongness, acceptability, justifiability. So for me, it is already embedded. The idea of the hope is already embedded in whenever we decide to follow the good or to do the good when we do our duties, when we fulfill our obligations. That even if there is the assumption that the other person might not do the good, the hope as a standpoint remains in ourselves. Because I think there would be no successful good action or good evaluation of an action if our standpoint, if our framework is coming from a hopeless condition. I think there might not be any action that can be done, no judgment that can be done if we are coming from that hopeless condition. And that's why I think it's important as well, the material conditions that we are part of. I think it's also important that we build on the material conditions that we find ourselves with. So that's I think that's part of good philosophizing as well, that we also address some privileges that some societies or some members of societies have, and we address that to support, you know, our community of the good or our pursuit of the good. We do not forget about supporting the material conditions that a lot of the population of the world has find ourselves with.
Okay, so we've got a good grasp on the theory there. Let's sort of bring it back down to earth. How does Kantian hope help to make sense of the kind of thing we were talking about earlier, you know, with regard to the work conditions of women in academic philosophy? What does a Kantian analysis of that predicament look like, first of all?
Yeah. I think one of the difficult things is that when one recognizes that one is in a system where alienation happens, and then apparently it comes from the general idea of work, the dehumanization, the depersonalization. Of course, when we are young, or in the university, in undergrads or graduates, we read it as theory, and then we hear about it from other people already in the workforce. And it hits you bad, well, it hit me bad even until now, that, oh, this is apparently this is what work is. This is what having a profession is. That it's part of the whole experience of a quarter of a population of human beings to have this type of situation. And then a lot of people telling you that, yeah, that's it. That's normal. That's part of the whole being a professional and all. And that is something that doesn't sit well with me. Because I always felt that work can also help us better ourselves. It helps us with our own ethics. I mean, work ethics. It helps us with our discipline, our routine. It helps us meet other people. It helps us with providing a space with crafting goals and then achieving goals. But the other things in the whole idea of work, especially if we add the idea of transactionality and efficiency, that is not guided by the spirit of what it is to be human and the spirit of human flourishing, or, you know, having virtues or achieving virtues. And again, the idea of happiness there. And again, when I think about the next generations having these forms of experience, and of course, the older generations who had to also experience this, it's something that makes me feel unhappy because of this is apparently what the workforce is. So the question becomes, okay, how do I make sure that at the very least I do not lose a shred of humanity? Or how do I make sure that I still am working on being a good person? Because if one lets go of the idea of a good person, it's as if we really do not care anymore. We don't care if there's corruption. We don't care if we are doing a good job. And I think the idea of care, that we find in feminist philosophy as well, but I think we can also find it here in Kant's hope and Kant's idea of happiness in his ethics, is that seeing the other person not just as a worker, as a colleague, but as a person. I think that's very important. And I think that's how Kant's critical philosophy has helped me personally, and seeing the other human being and ourselves not solely as a means, but already an end in ourselves. So how I understand this is that at any point in time, you're always whole. Seeing ourselves as a whole humans or whole human beings, having the absolute value of ourselves at any point in time. I think that's very important to remember at all times, and to see it that the other person that we are talking with or that we are relating with has also the same absolute value in the human dignity. That's what calls it anyway. The human dignity. It, in a way, it helps us remind ourselves that, oh, okay, it provides us a space wherein we can step back and, you know, re-educate ourselves. We learn that, okay, there is a possibility for us to choose to be a good person. No matter how unjust systems are, how difficult our work are, because, you know, there are some roadblocks, stumble blocks. Well, at the very least, we come honest with ourselves that we still want to be a good person. We are working on it. And hopefully that would be enough. Again, hopefully that would be enough.
For me, there is always a very large elephant in the room when we're talking about Kantian ethics in the context of feminist philosophy, because, of course, Kant was notoriously, let's say, old-fashioned when it came to questions of gender and race as well.
Yes.
I mean, he believed that men were naturally superior to women. He believed that women shouldn't be involved in politics or public affairs. He was what today we would call a white supremacist. He believed that humanity was hierarchically ordered into different races with the white race on top. So as a woman of Asian identity, how do you deal with this? I mean, is this something that you can easily ignore, is it sort of difficult to bracket off that sexism and that racism when you're working with Kant?
Yeah, I see myself having this journey with Kantian philosophy, and it has been a dream of mine that when I read all of his writings, is that to criticize him back. I take it as a duty as a Filipino woman philosopher to not just study about the canon, to not just study about Kant, but also to confront about his controversial issues and to provide a correct way, or at the very least, a working way of how his ideas would no longer work today. And I also tell this to my students because, again, I think I'm very heavy on continuity now. It is our job as Filipino philosophers to call out when things are not good, most especially since we have the colonial past. We had three colonial colonizers, or actually four, for the past 300 plus years. And I think it's important for us to talk about, oh, this is our standpoint. that one of our duties as Filipino citizens is to make sure that we are always in solidarity with people who are fighting for liberations, because we have come from a lot of struggles for liberation. And part of that is philosophizing and criticizing philosophers or ideas of philosophers that had been part of that the colonial past, and then making sure that we reference them not solely as we are supporting, but we are disagreeing with them. I think it's important to talk about it. I think what adds more to race, to racism, to sexism, is by not directly referencing them. And a lot of women philosophers has already been doing this. A lot of queer philosophers have been doing this. It's just that, of course, the structure, the pushback of still those who holds the power, they still have a little bit energy with them. But having conversations with different forms of philosophy and philosophizing, then we can say that, okay, we stand with you, we are here with you, we are also working on our own understanding and criticisms of where our Filipino philosophy is coming from. So I think it's one of my dynamic ways of doing philosophy, making sure that whatever I see, I take note of it, I reference it as something that will no longer work, that is morally ambiguous and that's morally detestable. And that, again, from coming from the Philippines as a Filipino woman philosopher, to work against it, to provide the criticism. Because if we go back to what Kant is saying, he always says that, you know, reason must always criticize itself. And I've always viewed that as, that includes you. that includes all of us, because we are always striving for the idea of equality, may that be in the face of reason, may that be in the face of other things.
Cassie Chidosho. She teaches philosophy at the University of the Philippines, and she's a founding member of the group Women Doing Philosophy. Cassie is going to be visiting Australia later this year as keynote speaker at a conference hosted by the Australasian Association of Philosophy, and I'll keep you up to date with more details as we get closer to that. And I'm David Rutledge. This has been The Philosopher's Zone. And as always, you can listen to this and any of our past episodes any old time you like via ABC Listen. Thanks for your company this week. See you next time.